Welcome, everyone, to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. On today's episode, we're talking about international trade and the imbalances that can persist in a global economy. Our guest today is Martin Wolf, one of the foremost experts on the subject, and I couldn't be more excited for you to hear his take on issues ranging from how certain countries interpret their current account position, to how institutions like the IMF and World Bank influence economic outcomes, to how politics ultimately determines how much we trade with each other. Martin has written several books on the subject of international trade, such as Why Globalization Works, Fixing Global Finance, and his most recent book, The Shifts and the Shocks, What We've Learned and Still Have to Learn from the Financial Crisis. In 2000, Martin was awarded the Commander of the British Empire for his services to financial journalism, and he is currently Chief Economics Commentator at the Financial Times, a position he's held since 1996. Martin, welcome to the show.
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
So Martin, many of the topics we'll be discussing today, you have addressed quite elegantly in your book, Fixing Global Finance. But I recently went back and reread your book, Why Globalization Works, and I was surprised how well the points you made in that book have aged. You wrote the book in 2004, prior to the financial crisis, and it's fascinating how much the challenges then mirror the challenges we face today. For instance, you said, quote, "The problem today is not that there's too much globalization, but that there is far too little. We can do a better job with the right mix of more liberal markets and more cooperative global governance." And I think in many ways this is still true. I think there are many assets, primarily people, especially people in the developing world, that are being underutilized. But I also think that many states are rather hesitant to fully embrace trade for fear of running trade deficits. Which leads me to my first question, is a trade deficit dangerous in and of itself? Doesn't a large trade deficit just mean the domestic economy can't produce enough of the goods it needs, so it imports those products? Or perhaps the country is rich and can afford to run large deficits because there is a high demand for its sovereign debt. What is your take?
I suppose the right framework from an economist's point of view in thinking about this is the trade balance, which can be thought about a little more broadly as the current account balance, which includes all services, including so-called non-factor services, the rewards to labor and capital. The trade balance is the mirror image of the capital account. So the current account is the mirror image of the capital account. And the crucial point is you can't run a persistent trade deficit or current account deficit, not quite the same thing, but close enough for our purposes, without running a capital account surplus. What does it mean to have a capital account surplus? It means that every year there is capital coming into your country. And that would sound rather desirable, wouldn't it? You can, because capital is coming into your country from abroad, foreigners are lending money to you or putting in equity into your companies, you can invest more, you can consume more, you can have a higher standard of living than otherwise. So this is rather a good thing. So if you're able to do that consistently, this would sound rather attractive. Sure. And that's why most economists would say there's nothing wrong with running a trade deficit or current account deficit. It just means people around the world are happy to put money into your economy consistently and allow you to spend more than you otherwise would. So that's great. The problem arises, because I think it's largely on the capital account that the problems do arise. That's what my two later books were about that you mentioned. The problem is if basically these decisions being made by the people who are providing you with the money, either they're buying your debt, government or private, or they're buying equity positions or companies, these are really bad decisions. Because if they're really bad decisions, there could be a crisis for a whole host of reasons at some point in which they decide, ah, that was a really bad decision. I need my money back now. And in that, if that happens to a country which has an open capital account, because that's what persuaded people to give them the money in the first place, then they usually get a balance of payments crisis or a currency crisis or a financial crisis, or very often all three. So the really big problem with persistent trade deficits, a point that it seems sort of impossible for the current president of the United States to understand, is really about the capital account, how the capital account works and the problems with the capital account we perceived, and therefore with the financial system that we've seen now for decades.
So you mentioned the president and his lack of understanding how the capital account works. Who should be concerned about the extent of their trade deficit? What type of economies should keep a close eye on their current account balance? For instance, you know, like, should the US or UK try to reduce their trade deficit? In my opinion, I just feel like that would make everybody poorer, would it not?
I think that the first question you have to ask is exactly the one you've asked, which has essentially two stages. So who's financing this capital account surplus or current account deficit? Where is the money coming from? What are the expectations of the people who are financing it? And what are the domestic counterparts? What is the spending that's going on? Now, by and large, if you look at the US, or particularly the US, but even the UK, the finance comes from people who are pretty confident in the basic stability of these countries, have confidence in their legal regimes, are not expecting extraordinarily high returns. In fact, on the whole, they're quite happy with quite low returns because they regard the money they're providing, the debt they're buying, as safe. And as long as those conditions hold, for these countries around current account deficits, seems mostly to work reasonably well. There is, however, and it's been very, very clear in the global financial crisis in 2007-09, there is even then a big problem. If the domestic spending that is the counterpart of this capital inflow, this what is, or in that case was, a huge household consumption boom, itself driven by a large rise in house prices, which turned out to be unsustainable, itself funded by an enormous credit boom, which was essentially collateralized by that housing.
Right.
So the key point there was, normally lending to the US is pretty safe, but when the current account deficit in the US got, I think, to 6 or 7%, something like that of GDP in 2007 or so, then it was telling you that there was a really big problem. And the really big problem was predominantly, and I didn't realize that at the time, a domestic financial problem, a domestic asset price problem. And when it collapsed, the same happened in Britain and in a number of other developed countries, you had a huge domestic and international crisis. In other countries which don't have that sort of basic stability, they can't, as the US and UK can, borrow in their own currencies, which they print, which move with the market, but they have to borrow because nobody has confidence in their currencies, in foreign currency, particularly the dollar. So they're borrowing a foreign currency that they can't print, can't create. If people are very nervous, so they insist on very high interest rates and relatively short terms, short maturities. And then when they get nervous, they pull all the money out, the exchange rate collapses, their foreign currency debt then rises in domestic currency terms dramatically. It's inevitable. They always, in that situation, get a domestic financial crisis, which they can't handle because they can't create the currency. The lender of last resort is somewhere else, i.e. in Washington. In that case, you get developing country crises, emerging country crises, and you saw this in March of this year when the COVID-19 hit. And those tend to create a really massive and deeply brutal crises in developing countries. And we had that in the Asian financial crisis in 97. We had in the so-called tequila crisis in Mexico in 95. We had it in the Latin American Korean direct debt crisis of 1981. A whole series of massive crises of this kind. Developing and emerging countries tend to be particularly vulnerable if they've borrowed a lot of money, wasted it, they haven't used it well in investment, productive investment, and then the creditors flee. So I would agree with you in conclusion that by and large, if there are going to be huge imbalances, there are huge lenders in the system that have to be counterpart borrowers. By and large, the best borrowers are the developed countries. And I think actually the best borrowers within them are probably their governments because right. they're the ones that can afford long-term debt.
You know, you talk about, being able to, print your own currency. And, I want to hear your take on, states that have complete monetary sovereignty. Obviously, this doesn't, apply to the euro, but, monetary sovereignty seems to be a hot topic right now, especially with the growth in the number of economists embracing modern monetary theory and Stephanie Kelton's book, The Deficit Myth, jumping off the shelves. If a country, like the United States, that can create money to finance its current account deficit, should they be at all concerned about the imbalance? Isn't inflation really the only constraint to a country monetizing the debt accumulated through trade imbalances?
Well, yeah, but that's a hell of a constraint. it is the sort of the core constraint. Ultimately, you are, if you are in a country that produces a currency that everybody wants to hold, domestic citizens are happy to hold, and foreigners are happy to hold, and a huge proportion of the dollars in the world are held by foreigners, voluntarily, foreign governments and foreign individuals, because it's seen as the safest currency you can hold. That's a wonderful situation to be in. It gives you tremendous degrees of freedom and power. And the US has enjoyed this status now, at least since the Second World War. I won't go into the interwar period, which is complex, but certainly some would argue since the First World War, but certainly since the Second World War. However, there was a period, and I lived in it, lived through it in Washington, the 70s, when that confidence was shaken. It was, and I remember it. The after Nixon left the gold standard, left the gold in 1971, he pursued his Fed chairman, who did what he wanted, a policy of massive monetary expansion, with the inflationary effects suppressed through wage price controls. There were the oil price shocks. Inflation hit 10%. And there was a generalized flight from the dollar into gold, into other assets, whatever there could be, mainly from the dollar. The dollar was very weak, and this reinforced the inflation cycle. And there was a real crisis of confidence in the dollar. People basically said, it's not a form of money I want to hold. I want to hold something else. And it created great instability. And in the end, to bring it back under control, for domestic reasons predominantly, you got Volcker, the Volcker shock, the huge recession of the early 80s, the biggest recession until the global financial crisis. So when you say, yeah, if people have your confidence in your currency, you have immense degrees of freedom, that is completely true. And people have more confidence in the dollar than any other currency, but confidence in a currency is never infinite. It's never unlimited. There are points in which people will say, these politicians don't recognize any constraints. They're going to print infinite quantities of this stuff. Sure. There is no limit. They think full employment is literally, say, I'm just imagining it, zero unemployment. And they were going to go and print money until you get zero unemployment. And if the fiscal deficit is 20% of GDP, well, who cares? They can print money.
Right.
But I can assure you, if they tried to do that, There will come a time, it won't be quick, when people will look at the US dollar and they say, well, what's the difference between that and the Argentine peso? None.
Right.
The Latin American governments have pursued those sorts of monetary policies for decades, and that's why they lost confidence of the markets and they got what was called original sin. What was original sin? Original sin was the idea, these people are not to be trusted with my money, I will never lend to them in their money, therefore I will only lend in dollars, and because I would only lend in dollars, they were in the problems I described earlier. Well, of course, that's not the US situation now. And it wasn't in the 70s. But if you're stupid enough, you can get there. So my question about Stephanie Elton and others is, what can you do to convince me that when you have the power to print as much money as you like, which in certain circumstances, like now, seems to be absolutely right, that when you do so, you will do so responsibly. And remember that I want to be sure that this money will remain a valuable asset, and that I, as a creditor, will have my interests taken into account. And that's the problem with MMT.
Right. So, yeah, I think we need to sort of take it with a grain of salt and realize that the structure for printing money to finance the deficit is there. Yes, we can do that, but we need to be wary of that being the MO for how we finance our trade deficits.
There's the famous remark, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Well, actually, there are occasions when there are free lunches, but there is never a situation when it's always a free lunch. And if you don't recognize those constraints politically, then people will not hold your currency.
It's very interesting. Shifting a little bit, Martin, I want to hear your thoughts on, natural or persistent trade imbalances, because it seems like some countries are stuck in a cycle of insolvency simply based on how their economy fits into the larger global economy. For example, if a poorer country can only export low-cost goods but has to import more expensive goods to meet the needs of its people, a current account deficit has to be financed. Otherwise, the country will have to instantly adjust, which we know can be quite painful. How do those poorer countries that maybe don't have the deepest capital markets improve their economic position, or are they merely stuck being the low-cost inputs to the developed world?
I think it's important to distinguish poverty from structural current account deficits. So there's a degree to which they tend to go together. But as it happens, some of the biggest surplus countries in the recent past, most obviously China, in the first decade of this century, China ran an enormous current account surplus. At one stage, it was 10% of GDP in, I think, 2007 or 2008. It was enormous. But China at that case, its GDP per head was probably about a tenth of the US level, maybe 15%. It was a very poor country.
Right.
So it's clearly possible to run a huge surplus. And there were other East Asian examples which did the same thing when you're relatively poor. But there are reasons. So let me go up the ladder a little bit. If you're a very, very poor country, basically, it's very difficult to raise your savings a lot. Because if you've got very low incomes, and basically most people are very poor, to raise your savings, you have to suppress consumption. And to suppress consumption means going without, which if you already have very, very little, going without means people starve. And many countries in Africa, particularly in the recent past, not all by any means, have been in this situation. So if you want to raise investment levels, you want to spend more on education, on infrastructure, build up your economy, you need to spend more than your income in that just to get the thing going, if you like. It's a sort of pump priming process. And that's why, by and large, countries that poor need import capital, import, which is where I started, their capital accounts have to be in surplus. And that usually means they can't borrow from markets. So that's usually come from aid. Historically, that's been recognized now since the Second World War, the development, the creation of IDA, the International Development Association in the World Bank, reflected that need. And so these very poor countries clearly need large capital inflows. And the big question, of course, is do they have the policy regimes to use it well? I think in general they've improved, but that's a big question. Then if you get into the middle income sort of countries, you get into, you find there are countries that fall into different socioeconomic categories, some of which are quite surprising. By and large, as soon as you get beyond this minimum income, if you look at the Asian developing countries, and here I would even include South Asia, but very much East and Northeast Asia in their development process. These are countries where, for a host of reasons, households tend to save a lot. They will go without to an incredible degree. And they're quite happy to accept companies earning very large profits. So they tend to be able to finance their investment at home. This has even been true of India. It doesn't need huge capital inflows. It saves the Indians, it might surprise you, national savings in India as a share of GDP is, I think, almost double America's. That's rather a shock, isn't it? And we're not even talking about China, which is somewhere else altogether. And this is sort of slightly, but these figures are broadly right. So they can finance their investment at home. Then it's a question of, do they invest it well? And in China's case, and some of the other countries in East Asia, Singapore is a classic, Taiwan is another, they've run huge surpluses forever because they save so much, they simply can't absorb it at home, and they're financing the world. So those are the Asians. And then you get other countries like the Latin Americans, which have chronically low savings forever. I mean, unbelievably low savings. A country like Brazil saves about as little as the US, even though it's relatively poor. Whenever it has an investment boom, it runs a huge current account deficit. So the real drivers here, when you get away from the poor, very poor countries, is your country a country where households and businesses save a lot or not? By and large, the US and UK are very low saving countries for developed countries. So they tend to import a lot of capital. They tend to run deficits. Their economy is built around that. And the Germany, Japan is somewhat on the other side of that. Their economies are built around having excess savings. And most East Asians are excess savers. Most Latin Americans are deficient savers. Chile's been a bit of an exception. And these seem to be very deeply structural characteristics of societies. They seem to reflect, they go on for decades, they seem to reflect very profound features of societies, culturally and so forth. And the economy structure then builds around it. Because if you run a structural current account deficit because you have a structural savings deficiency and quite good investment opportunities like the US, that's a good example of a developed country, then what happens, of course, is if you're going to run a current account deficit, is you're a net importer, large net importer of tradable goods, which means domestic production of tradable goods is not very large relative to what it is in a country like Germany, which has a current account surplus of 8% of GDP, while the US has a deficit of 4 or 5. So that's a big difference. And as a result, Germany has a huge net surplus production of tradable goods, manufacturers in this case, and that's baked in the cake of their huge savings surplus in Germany and the huge savings deficiency in the United States. And that is fundamentally what drives the trade balance and the structure of the economy, and therefore the weakness of production of manufacturers in the US, which of course was part of what got Mr. Trump elected.
Right. You know, it's I'm glad you mentioned the Latin American economies. I think one of the more troubling aspects of this whole process is that, you know, some countries are forced to borrow, many countries are forced to borrow in foreign currencies because of their poorly developed capital markets at home. Are balance of payments crises in a way inevitable if an economy is forced to borrow in stronger foreign currencies like the dollar, or are there policies, you know, for instance, capital controls that could help prevent or lessen the effects of such outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that if you have an open capital account and basically the world's wealthy, which might well include your own wealthy, let's be very clear about this, you know, all these Latin Americans who have assets in Florida, right? They don't trust your currency because they don't trust your politicians and they don't trust your central bank. So they don't want to lend in pesos or whatever it may be. They want to lend in the dollar. They think that will make them safer. They trust the Fed more than their own central bank. And by and large, I think correctly, right? So, and ditto, you need to persuade American lenders to these countries to, if you want them to lend in your currency, you're going to have to pay them a lot more. And that's expensive, right? So you promise to pay them in dollars. Of course, even there, it'll be expensive because they reckon, well, things go wrong, you'll default, which just look what's happened to Argentina, you know, for the ninth time, I think. So my view is, I've tended to take the view that if you're a developing country without a good reputation, or perhaps to put it another, if you're a developing country and you can't borrow in your own currency internationally or at all, then you just shouldn't borrow because it's going to create a crisis sooner or later. But if you are going to borrow in a foreign currency, and there have been a few cases of this, then you have to really make sure that the money is well used and that the structure of finance is suitable for your economies. So you go for long-term borrowing, not short-term borrowing. You make sure your banking sector is not hugely exposed to foreign currency. And if necessary, you have capital controls, as you said, which the Chinese have and the Indians have and the Koreans used to have when they were a developing country. And it seems to me perfectly sensible because there are risks here which are very difficult to manage because of this fundamental lack of confidence in your country and currency. And when that lack of confidence comes to the boil in a crisis of some kind, maybe one you have no control over, an oil price shock, a COVID-19, a financial crisis somewhere else, then you're in terrible trouble. So the best thing is just not to do it. But if you're going to do that, then of course you have to come back to what I said. You need to raise savings at home. Because otherwise you can't fund your own development. So that means you have a structural weakness, and solving it by borrowing in dollars is not a very good way. But and you can't borrow in your own currency very much. So then you have to do something else to develop. And the key thing is the domestic politics of these countries prevents raising savings because it involves always a huge internal distributional struggle.
Yeah. That's excellent. Let's shift to institutions for a moment. You know, our listeners may not know that you worked at the World Bank after you finished your studies at Oxford. And in your book, Why Globalization Works, you talk a little bit about your time at the bank. You said, quote, "By the late 1970s, I had concluded that for all the good intentions and abilities of its staff, the bank was a fatally flawed institution. The most important source of its failures was its commitment to lending almost regardless of what was happening in the country it was lending to." And then you go on to say, as a result, its efforts were often either unnecessary or wasteful. I have two questions from this. First, do you still, you know, think this is the case? And second, do you think the World Bank or other institutions like the IMF can do a better job structuring their assistance packages so that balance of payment crises become a less frequent occurrence? For instance, you know, could the IMF move away from requiring structural reforms as a condition for lending? I just feel like there should be, or perhaps there are, you know, pro-growth options available that won't put struggling economies in an endless cycle of austerity. What is your take?
Well, first of all, these are very, very difficult issues. And I suppose since I am now 40 years older than when I left the World Bank, I must have learned a little, please God. But the main point, so I'll just focus on one aspect because there are so many questions. My dominant experience at work at the World Bank was working on East Africa and India. That was about three quarters of my period there. And in that decade, both went very, very badly. So it's rather depressing. And I went to the World Bank as a very idealistic person in, you know, I was 25, and I thought development is the biggest challenge in the world for economists.
Sure.
Pretty obviously, you know. There was a stagnant so-called third world, and so it seemed very important. So, and I was working on African countries, mostly particularly on Kenya and Zambia, and then on India. And what was I seeing? Well, at this stage, we were giving them quite a lot of money. Not enormous, but quite a lot of money. And the World Bank was in the 70s, it was the biggest donor by far. Private capital had not really reemerged after the Second World War in the 70s. So they were still official capital. Mostly World Bank, other development banks were providing the money. The IMF, except in the crises, was not so central. Of course, it was during the oil crisis, first oil shock and second shock, but as consistent lenders, the bank was central. Now, it seemed to me very, very clear if you were looking at what these countries were doing, that they were pursuing policies that were profoundly inimical to growth, massively distorted trade and industrial policies, which were leading to enormous corruption at very rapid, in Africa, very quickly, facilitating rent extraction of all forms. The money that was going was not going to the poor. Very clearly not going to the poor, far from it. And growth had basically, particularly in India, had stopped. I mean, in the 70s, India, which was a desperately poor country still, its GDP per head in real terms was probably 3 or 4% US levels, 3 or 4%. And this is a country. What was the population then? 300 or 400 million. Of course, it's much bigger now. It had recently had serious problems with famine in that time. And then it was hit by the oil shocks. And the problem with the oil shocks is that because of its terrible trade policies, its exports were just, I think the figure was, so I'll just focus on 4% of GDP. So unbelievably tiny. So then the oil price quadruples. Oil is an essential import. That essentially means the entire export earnings of India were swallowed up in getting their oil in. And they couldn't import anything else. Growth just stopped.
Right.
So they had to raise exports dramatically. They had to do that. They had to completely change their trade and industrial policy regime. They had to shift resources into agriculture. That was to some degree happening. It was obvious that what was then called the Hindu rate of economic growth, which is about 1% per head, wouldn't deliver India from poverty in 150 years. So it seemed to be. So what was the World Bank doing? Well, I thought, as I said, I was young and innocent, that in this crisis, the World Bank should have said, we're not going to lend to you to continue with policies which will not allow you to grow.
Right,
which will not give greater prosperity to people. We can give you a little Band-Aid by getting crisis lending, but it's not going to solve the problem. And that's what we did in the first oil crisis, which I worked on. So the first oil crisis, 74, that was when I was the senior India division economist, and that's what we were doing. I thought they had to liberalize, and if they did, and move to a more pro-growth pattern of growth, the growth rate could accelerate massively and it would transform India for the better. Now, it so happens, I think, in this case, I'll just focus on this, I was vindicated because in the 80s, liberalization started a bit. And then in 91, they had another huge balance of payment crisis, so big that they just couldn't get enough money to bail them out. Right. So they completely changed their policies. They liberalized, trade exploded, the ratio of trade to GDP exploded, imports were suddenly very freely available, the economy became much more competitive, and Indian growth rates went from 1% of GDP per head, 1% per head, to about 5 or 6% per head, which is a big deal. And as a result, in the last 30 years, though it's slowing down again, the average Indian's income has accelerated dramatically. It's now about 11 or 12% of US. So it's tripled relative to the US. And I thought that the World Bank is basically facilitating this nonsense. I think the same was true in Africa. Now, were the reforms perfect? No, of course they weren't. I think they were better in India than anywhere else. But my basic view was we weren't focusing enough on the requirements of efficient policy making. And the policies we were supporting were, as I said, rent extracting and leading to gigantic corruption. So I still hold very much with what I thought then. And I think by and large, most policymakers now sort of understand that. In fact, I think the understanding of economics of trade generally, though it's less true in India with Mr. Modi, is better than in developed countries these days. But I think this is the great lesson I learnt, that aid works perfectly well, but only in the right domestic political context.
Right, right. You know, you mentioned Modi, and you highlight how the successes of India liberalization. How does politics fit into all this? Because I feel like if we can just get leaders to better understand the forces involved in trade, you know, they could use that information to improve their country's economic standing. When you look at the political side of what we've discussed, do you think some leaders fail to fully grasp the dynamics involved in their trade position? Do you think that maybe they focus too much on, you know, whether their country's in deficit or surplus rather than how those balances fit into their global trading position?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think very few policymakers really understand the interaction of the different accounts we're talking about, the current account or trade account, the capital account, and how they interact with the domestic economy, with income, well, saving and investment, saving consumption, saving, investment, incomes, and consumption and investment. So there's a whole set of balance sheets here and income and expenditure accounts that interact. They all have to add up.
Sure.
Having a model in your head of how these flows and the associated shifts and changes in the balance sheet over time work, it's useful economics, but it's quite difficult to get your head around if you're not familiar with accounting and then can do it on a national level. So I think very few policymakers really understand in some deep way how the capital account and the current account interact. They also, and what I'm going to say now is not true, but some of them don't even understand how individual changes in one individual business interact with others. So what is leading to the closure of a company in one place? Why is this plant that used to make X in my country now being outcompeted by somebody else in some other country? And then, of course, because this is a multilateral system, everything interacts with everything else globally. You can't just add up bilateral flows. You have to understand how bilateral flows add up into the overall multilateral picture. So this is all quite complicated. Now, let's suppose something goes wrong. If things are okay, you're quite prosperous, the economy is growing, jobs, if you lose some old jobs, you get good new jobs, income inequality isn't right. You know, basically things are okay. Nobody really worries about it. But let's suppose for a whole host of reasons, that is not what is happening. Income, people are losing jobs and not finding good new ones. You have a financial crisis, which leads to a long period of low growth and weak investment and stagnant real incomes. Well, then there are two ways for political processes to respond. One way, which is sort of desirable, but it's basically not what happens on the whole. It happens in some small countries, you know, Switzerland, sensible people. But is to say, what's going on? What is the problem? How do we understand this? Let's talk about it and work out a strategy to deal with this. And there's another way of approaching this, which I'm obviously caricaturing, is, well, some beastly foreigner is doing something beastly to us and we've got to stop him or, you know, stop them. In other words, blame someone for something. And if you're going to blame people for something, you know, it's pretty basic. If you're going to look for a scapegoat, you will always look for an outsider. And the foreigner is the ultimate outsider. So the foreigner as immigrant, the foreigner as exporter, the unreasonably competitive producer of something you used to make yourself, who now provides something better and more and cheaper. These are the people who are to blame. They are doing something horrible to you. And this is a very old game. Of course it is. And it's completely natural. The trouble is, the policies that follow from that don't solve anything. They don't make anyone better off. Now, it seems to me pretty clear, even before COVID-19, lots of work on this. If you look at what Mr. Trump was doing, he didn't reduce the US deficit. And that was predictable given his fiscal policy, because that hugely expanded demand. So, of course, he didn't. He didn't even solve the bilateral balance with China to any significant degree. He sure messed up trade, and he didn't make the economic position of the people he was trying to help better, because if you, for example, protect steel, you raise the price of steel to anyone who wants to use it, which far more industries. So, but I'm afraid blaming foreigners is the name of the game in this situation if you're not prepared to address these things relatively rationally. And here is a very final point. Very smaller countries, not the US in this case, so even the UK, Germany, smaller countries, they know they can't thrive. They could never have reached their current living standards without an open economy. We couldn't possibly be self-sufficient. And it would just be ridiculous to think we could. So making the most of trade is impossible. The US, however, is so big and was so near to being completely self-sufficient half a century ago that there's still a normative idea that whenever you import something, it's sort of a crime against sovereignty. And that makes this sort of protectionist rhetoric more attractive. And I'm afraid I have no simple solution to this because it involves, the solutions involve first understanding the underlying dynamics and secondly, developing more general policies to help people affected by the genuine and real adjustment processes involved. And helping them involves spending and involves intelligent thought through policymaking, which people like the Swedes and the Germans and normally do. But the US just is very resistant to doing it. And I don't know how this is going to play out.
Yeah. Well, let's continue a little bit on the blame game. And, you know, I just think about the growth of populism, you know, that is happening right now. How do you think, you know, the growth of populism has impacted the globalization debate specifically? You know, I keep thinking back to what happened, you know, after the Soviet Union collapsed. People began to trumpet you know, the fruits of a more globalized economy, you know, only to then see, you know, globalism on the defensive a decade later. You know, we see this again in the early 2000s when we celebrated the innovation of new financial products and how they facilitated more global capital flows and improved economic outcomes, you know, only to then see those same financial products, you know, fail in 2008. You know, what are the challenges of this ebb and flow? And do you think we are entering or are already in, you know, a global movement away from trade?
Yeah, I think we probably are. After the global financial crisis, there was a very clear contraction in certain forms of capital flow already. So on the capital side, and that was particularly true of flows intermediated by banks. To some extent, this was replaced by flows intermediated by asset management. But overall, I mean, some important areas of capital market integration already shrank. On trade, the shift was very, very clear. Before the financial crisis, world trade was growing on average about twice as fast as world GDP, world output, over pretty well 30 years. In fact, it had been growing faster than world output for most of the time since 1950, since the Second World War. Since the global financial crisis, that's now 12 years ago, basically they've grown in parallel. So we wouldn't say that we have been radically deglobalizing. So there are some areas where we have, but it's clearly the globalization process halted. Now, there are two broad reasons for this. One reason is that many of the opportunities we had to expand globalization had just been exploited, particularly the so-called unbundling of value chains, the cross-border integration of supply chains. That had been to a large extent done by 2005-06. And the second reason is, well, there hasn't been any significant trade liberalization, not really significant trade liberalization anywhere since 2001, which is a long time ago. And that was, of course, the now very controversial entry of China into the WTO. So that's about 20 years. So for these two reasons, globalization had already weakened the impulse very dramatically. But of course, there's now been a very strong backlash. And I think the backlash has probably two or three main elements. The first and probably right now most important is the breakdown in relations between the West and China. China's rise was obviously the biggest trade shock of the last 30 years or so. And it has created lots of problems and questions and challenges, which were first ignored and then led to a sort of breakdown in confidence, which has been reinforced by other things which are not directly related to trade, like China's rise as a military superpower, like COVID-19 and who's responsible for that. So the first thing that has happened is the idea that we're all in a sort of global trading community is gone because the West, in particular the US and China, are now in a completely different place. The second big thing that has happened is that over a very long period, particularly in the US, but not uniquely in the US, quite substantial parts of the population didn't do very well economically. And that really seems to have started already in the 90s, perhaps even earlier, 80s. And of course, after the global financial crisis, this was quite general. We've had pretty stagnant real incomes per head for many, many, many people across the Western world. And they're looking for scapegoats. great. You know, what they promised would happen, what they felt had been promised to them, that they would, by and large, get better off every year and their children would get better off every year. That was the future, the American dream or whatever you call it. And, you know, the German dream is all the same. That people feel this isn't working for us. Who's to blame?
Right.
And they elected politicians, quite understandably, what we call populist politicians, though I think they're faux populists, who say, I've got the answer. You know, we'll bash the foreigners and we'll have, we'll get rid of the trade surplus of China with us and you'll be fine. And that was a second protectionist thing, which is very, very important. And the third, I think, which is quite specific but very important and perfectly understandable, is that once you're in this sort of the global power struggle that I mentioned at the beginning, then people start saying, are we dominating all the most important technologies? Are we independent, genuinely independent in the technologies that are likely to determine our futures, economically, but also in terms of security? And so what you get is not just protectionism of the normal kind because people are miserable and they want something done about it, and they want their jobs, these industrial jobs. You specifically want to start breaking up the links that bound you in frontier technologies. And then you get the Huawei problem and now TikTok and everything like that. So essentially, you're moving into an environment in which trade is no longer looked at through an economic lens. It's looked at, and I think this is perfectly understandable, though it's a question of how to do it, through the security lens. And for those three reasons, I probably should have put in the third at second, but it doesn't really matter the order. For those three reasons, I think that the global trade integration story is coming to an end. Now, there's just one really big point about this. This isn't like the old Cold War. China is a huge economy, not a very weak one, as the Soviet Union was. And it has huge, it's the biggest trading power. It has the huge trading relations with everybody. And lots of countries have much more in trade relation with China than they do with the West, than with them with the US, even Latin American countries. So the question, of course, is, if we're going to sort of going to break up the world, as we are, I think, doing, is who's going to end up going where?
Right.
And I think the safe thing to say at the moment is we don't know. But we're moving geopolitically, as well as geoeconomically, into a new world. And it's a very threatening one. It's one in which a lot can go wrong. And if we don't manage it very, very carefully, we can have some very, very big problems which go vastly beyond the subjects we're talking about.
Right. So if we are moving away from trade, moving away from being a more globalized economy, you know, what are some of the near-term and long-term dangers of this? And, you know, is there anything that we can do to get, you know, more people to recognize the benefits of trade?
Well, right at the moment, it's difficult for the reasons I discussed. I think at the moment, I think of this sort of a bit like this. Put the US to one side, because the US is sui generis, because it's a superpower. It has a long protectionist history, and it still, I think, by and large, is sort of accepted in the body politic that if push comes to shove, we can be self-sufficient. Most countries don't think of things like that, including China, by the way. And the reason is China doesn't have the natural resource independence that the US has. It's far more people and a much weaker natural resource base. And every other country in the world is just too small. So they all know in their bones they're going to rely on trade. So where the US is going to end up with this, I really don't know. Of course, it links with the broader question of the American political future. But I expect the US to become and remain pretty seriously protectionist for the immediate, for the indefinite future. I've sort of, if I may say so, written the US out of this picture, because I think the politics, it seems to me pretty clear that in this area, though their trade policy wouldn't be like Trump's, which is sui generis, never been anything like this before. But I expect that Mr. Biden, if he were president, to be also pretty protectionist, that everything I hear is like that. Now, elsewhere, it won't work like that. All the European countries know they need to trade, and that's true of Japan, and you know, most places, it's true of China. So the question is how they structure this trade. I think there will be a tendency towards deepening regional arrangements. One of the answers the Europeans have is to deepen their regional arrangement, their European arrangement. You can see that already with the reinforcement of the fiscal side. It's a sort of aspect. I think they will try and pursue and are pursuing free trade agreements with countries all over the world, Japan, Latin America. I mean, I think they will try and create regional blocks. The Europeans will be very keen on this. And they will have, as America will, some very complicated relations with China. And I think China itself is very clearly, through the Belt and Road Initiative and in other ways, to try to create a large group of countries which trade very intensively with China, whose infrastructure is deeply integrated into China's, and that will be particularly true, of course, of Central Asia, very important part, supplier of commodities and so forth, but also countries in East and South Asia. And China will try to create, through these physical links and also through using the RMB, a sort of trading bloc. So I think we are likely to see in those parts of the world for which trade is incredibly important, the creation of trading blocks, which sort of brings us a little bit back to the 19th century imperial type system, which is what the WTO and the GATT, created by America, by the way, for this reason, was designed to prevent. One of the things that, you know, the Americans have mostly forgotten their own history. One of the reasons the US was so keen on creating the GATT, Cordell Hull and so forth, was to get rid of imperial preference, which was the biggest imperial system, the British imperial preference system. I won't go into all that history. But that, I think, is where it will end. I think we will end up with trading blocks, probably three main ones, around the US. The problem the US has is it doesn't really have very important neighbors. Its major trading partners are in another continent. It's quite a big issue. Around the US, around Europe, around China, with complicated interactions among them, among these big groups, and with lots of countries around the world trying to do the best they can to trade off, to manage to have good relations with all of them. How that will work, I don't know, but it will be much messier than anything we have seen in the post-war period, because up till now, the dominant trading powers in the whole post-war period were the US and its allies. Right. So that was the core. And Russia didn't matter. So this is a much more complicated world, and I'm worried, very worried, brings me back to sort of Graham Allison's Thucydides trap, that if we move into this imperial structure type world, this will foment rivalries which can spill over into war.
Well, Martin, thank you so much for joining us today. I know our listeners and I have learned very much from you, and we thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us. If you want to get more Martin Wolf, two of his books, Fixing Global Finance and The Shifts and the Shocks, What We've Learned and Still Have to Learn from the Financial Crisis, are available for purchase on the Demand Side's library page. And if you want to access all of Martin Wolf's opinion pieces, subscribe to Financial Times Digital at ft.com. Martin, thanks again.
Great pleasure. Very great pleasure.
Well, that's it for us here at the Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion of the unavoidable imbalances of global trade with our very special guest, Martin Wolf. Make sure to check out all the episodes of The Demand Side on The Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to visit thedemandside.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose the demand side. Until next time.